Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska!
I think it's the best show on the air ever that has been. It's weird how good it is. It's so strange.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, October 26, 2022, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 645 of the Biden-Harris administration, 13 days until the 22 midterms. Find me on Instagram at TheBobSeska, Twitter, BobSeska_go, and our Patreon is BobSeskaShow.com. If you listen to only one interview show of mine, let it be this one. Political strategist Simon Rosenberg is here today with some much-needed optimism about where we are with the midterms. I guarantee you will feel a hell of a lot better about November 8 after you listen to Simon today. Don't get complacent, of course. We still have to leave everything on the field, but still, there are some positive indicators in the early vote and previous special elections. They're getting lost in the cable news horse race narrative, so get ready. You can follow Simon at SimonWDC on Twitter, and the website for his think tank is ndn.org. Meantime, please help support this show by subscribing to our bonus content at BobSeskaShow.com. All right, here's my talk with the great Simon Rosenberg.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
Appreciate the opportunity to be with you today.
Yeah. And you know, one of the reasons my girlfriend Kimberly Johnson loves having you on her show is your optimism. But everything that you say that's positive on Twitter is all backed up by numbers. It's not just rose-colored glasses. You're not just painting the story with an artificially positive spin. Everything is well-sourced with the facts, right?
Yeah, look, we have to be glass half full. I mean, it's just in life in general, right? It's you just live a happier life if you can see the positive in things. And I think that for whatever reason, and we could have a long conversation about this, the bummer of 2016, the nightmare of the arrival of Donald Trump, the whatever it is, pessimism and has become too powerful a force in our family. Mm-hmm. And what I have been trying to do this year is I worked for Bill Clinton 30 years ago.
Yeah.
He believed that optimism was the most powerful force in politics. It was really, it was essential to his candidacy and
his presidency. Yeah, he was the first candidate who used hope as a campaign message. It wasn't Barack Obama. It was you guys in 1992.
Yeah. And Bill Clinton actually grew up in a town called Hope in Arkansas, which is almost unbelievable, right, to think about. But it was the idea that we can be better tomorrow was the essential part of the Clinton argument, right? Mm-hmm. Which is despite it all, right? Yeah. We can make things better. And he is right. I mean, the country is far better today than it was in so many ways. But I think what's important now for Democrats is that I don't know how this sort of pessimism has became so prevalent, but it's critical now to recognize the kind of, I joked today on Twitter that Democrats have to start using more declarative sentences and stop using but and however so much. And Congressman Gallego, Ruben Gallego, responded and said, you know, we've got to stop making Republican arguments for them, right? We have to be better about making our arguments for us. And that's what I, you know, somebody who worked in the television news business and, you know, and grew up in modern, you know, the, you know, sort of modern communications, I do believe, and also I was a guest on Fox News for 17 years. I did thousands of appearances on Fox. And I, whatever the question was, I always would start by saying, well, let me tell you how I see it. And I would put out something positive and to lay, to start with an engagement where I wouldn't let them define the engagement as being negative. And I think that we have to learn how to do that ourselves. I think at this point, given the stakes in the election, given the stakes of what's happened to the Republican Party, the kind of pessimism and anger and frustration that exists is self-indulgent, frankly, in the Democratic Party. We don't, we just don't have any, there's no time. It's a waste of time and energy. We just need to be working as hard as we possibly can. This is a very close election. It may be the closest election that I've ever really been part of, maybe with the exception of the 2000 election. And I just don't think anybody has any idea what's going to happen, which is why, you know, we just have to put our heads down, vote early, make our calls, our texts, you know, our door knocking, give as much money as we can. And we got to end strong here. And I would still rather be us than them when it comes to the election.
Going back to what you said about appearing on Fox News for 17 years, clearly you see a political benefit, a persuasive benefit in entering that bubble. Is that something we should be doing more often? Because I know there's a lot of debate on the Democratic side. Should we just ignore Fox News or should we participate in there? Is there any way to get onto Fox News and have an effect? Can you really move the needle by going on Fox News? I know Pete Buttigieg is doing it all the time. Yeah. And he's really, really effective at it.
I think it's really changed. Fox has changed. It used to be that you could go on Fox and say your piece and, you know, you would debate with the conservative and everything would be in sort of a conservative frame. But It wasn't you know, you could get your point across. And my view and what I told people at Fox, as long as I get to say my piece, right, I'm going to keep coming back. And I was never paid, by the way. I was never, I didn't want to be paid by Rupert Murdoch. I didn't think it was appropriate. And yeah, I showed that for a long time, you could have constructive, positive engagement. And I felt it was important for Fox viewers to see reasonable Democrats. And also for me, it made me better at my job, right? I was confronting and dealing with conservative arguments, you know, three times a week on live television, you know, when the stakes were high, you couldn't make any mistakes. And so I felt it really made me better at the work that I did. And so I loved it. It was like working out for me. But then Fox changed. After Roger Ailes left and Trump got elected, we went from being people on the other team to being enemies. And it became very adversarial. Far too adversarial for it. Yeah. And I quit. I just quit on my own in 2018. And Fox now isn't fair and balanced as it used to be. They've actually dropped that as a slogan. And there's very few slots for Democrats to come on. And they're usually in the most, you know, adversarial possible, you know, construct. And so, yes, I do think, like Beto O'Rourke is doing in this election, that you have to go and contest votes wherever they are. Yeah. And we can't, you know, I'm an old war room guy. I mean, the basic premise of the war room was that you had to win the information game every day. You had to get your positive story out. And then when they attacked you, you had to rebut it right away because the premise was that rebutted attacks that are not rebutted stick in people's minds. And I think that, you know, we have to be, I think in general, Bob, we have to be more aggressive in, as a party. I think that we... Sometimes there's the idea that you can be aggressive and be an advocate for yourself without being an asshole, right? There's a line there, and we have to find that line better. And we have to try harder to bring, you know, Clinton used to describe people who didn't support him as people who are not yet my supporters. Right. And I think we have to have that view. We have to win over more folks. in the coming years to get to where we want to be as a national party.
Right. It's 30 years on since the war room, since 1992. Do you think the days of normalcy in politics are over, or are you hopeful that we might end up clawing back some sense of stability in our politics?
I mean, only if we win. You know, I mean, we have to win and win and win and make the Republican Party view MAGA as a political dead end, and so that they leave MAGA behind and return to being something more like a conventional Western center right, you know, political party, which they aren't anymore. And you know, the threat that we have is not the Republican Party; it's that the Republican Party has been overtaken by extremists and extremism, and that it's why we need. I think one of the most interesting projects ahead of us for the next few years is that we need to find common cause and create some kind of working relationship with the people we used to call never Trumpers, the anti-MAGA Republicans, and formally bring them into our coalition to expand our coalition. Right. We got 52% of the vote in the last two elections. Republicans got 46%. MAGA has never gotten more than 47% in the three elections since Trump won the nomination. You know, what we need to do is we need to try to get our number up to 54, 55. By entering into this coalition with Liz Cheney and Bill Kristol and Michael Steele and Joe Scarborough and others who are no longer Republicans, but they're not necessarily Democrats, and they may never become Democrats, by the way. I mean, this is, and that's okay, that we need to have a temporary arrangement, as we saw during the January 6th committee hearings, where, you know, the Democrats and Liz Cheney worked wonderfully together to defend our democracy. And I think that that's going to be an area of opportunity for us, Bob. And it gets to the core of what you're talking about. I mean, I've had extensive conversations now with people like Bill Kristol and Michael Steele and others in that world. And in part, they trust me because they saw me on Fox News for years. They saw me being respectful to conservatives, even though I disagreed with them. And so I have, you know, some chits stored up in that regard. And so I'm optimistic that we, you know, we need to be creative about this. This is something that's an important party-wide project, you know, and I think they're ready to enter into some kind of coalition with us. I mean, if we were in a parliamentary democracy, like most democracies in the world, that group of Republicans would have split off and created their own party. That party would have joined our party in a coalition.
Yeah.
Liz Cheney would have gone into our cabinet, right? But because of our system, we don't really have a way of doing that. And we're going to need to invent it. We're going to need to do something interesting together with them. Even if we have a disappointing midterm, we lose a chamber. This is about, you know, the next 4, 6, 8 years. I think the time that we need to thoroughly defeat MAGA is going to be, unfortunately, over several election cycles. I don't think this is going to happen quickly. And that's why, you know, we have to be steely-eyed about this and recognize that, you know, we've got to do the best we can here, but we also have another election coming up in 2 years. And, you know, we're going to be battling these guys for a long time.
There's absolutely a benefit to welcoming Never Trumpers into our coalition. And one of the reasons is they prioritize winning. I think a little bit more often, Democrats often prioritize policy, and that's fair. I think that is effective in some ways. But a priority on winning elections is something that I think the Never Trumpers bring back to the table, as well as the ability to know where the weaknesses are in the current Republican Party, just based on experience. And these are all valuable things that I think they're not necessarily missing on the Democratic side, but they may be a little bit lacking in terms of how we certainly approach elections. So in that regard, that's enormously beneficial to the Democratic side. And I don't know why anyone would kind of sneeze at that and say, well, you know, we don't need that. We don't need to join with them. They're, you know, they're traitors. They're responsible for the Iraq war. Why would we want to join up with them? Well, we want to win elections because the stakes are so high, as you've been saying. So,
And Bob, let me tell your listeners, let me tell you why I'm optimistic and why I would rather be us than them when it comes to this election. Let me go through a couple things.
Sure.
First of all, this has been a good week of polling for us. I mean, if you go to 538, all the tracks that have been released this week, with the exception of one, have been either, you know, the Republicans haven't led in any of them except in the Rasmussen track where Democrats actually gained 4 points. It's still a little bit Republican, but we gained 4 points. There's now three weekly tracks that have shown us gaining 3 points, 3 points, and 4 points, including a very influential one, the Economist YouGov poll, which is considered to be one of the best polls in American politics, showed us gaining 4 points this week from last week. So this idea that the election has sort of tipped and has moved towards the Republicans is no longer true. It may have been true a week ago, but it isn't true anymore. And it's important that we work to correct this national narrative. The second thing is, as you all know, we had very good polls in Pennsylvania this week. We had some good polls in Nevada as well, you know, that showed things being a little bit better in both states than previous polling. So very good polls there. And we had a good poll in Wisconsin as well, showing the race dead even. The next reason I'm really optimistic is that our candidates have more money than their candidates do. And the reason that matters is that, you know, there's something in American politics called the lowest unit rate. Candidates pay far less money for an ad than an outside group does. So, for example, in Las Vegas, there was a study done last week that a candidate ad, a single ad, cost $21,000. If you're a super PAC, that same ad is $150,000. That means that for if we spend $150,000 and the Republican super PAC spends $150,000, our ad runs seven more times than the super PAC ad. So the Republicans are spending more money than we are in the final 2 weeks, but we may actually put more ads on the air, which is really all that matters, right? Because we were, because of our national grassroots giving our campaigns huge amounts of money, they have more money than the Republican candidates. Third, the reason I'm really optimistic is the early vote numbers are really encouraging. It's just true.
Yeah.
I mean, we are early vote is up over 2018, which was a, you know, historic high turnout election, the highest midterm in 100 years. We're seeing the early vote is tracking above the 2018 numbers. And also, you know, we're doing better than both 2018 and 2020. The electorate is more Democratic than it was in 2018 and 2020. So the electorate is bigger and it's more Democratic. We have a slightly bigger piece of a bigger pie. And let me give you I just published this data on my Twitter feed.
Yeah.
At this, according to Target Early, which has the best and most comprehensive data on the early vote, we at this point in 2018, Republicans had about 200,000 more votes than we did. Across the whole country.
Wow.
Right now, we have 1.8 million more votes than they do.
Holy crap.
So we're 2 million votes. We have 2 million more votes at this point than we had net, right, over them than we had 4 years ago. And what's happening with the early vote is, let me make sure your audience knows, and I'll be done with my happy back up full talk. Is that, because I think this is really important, and as anyone who follows me on Twitter knows, I've been going crazy about the early vote, and it's important that everyone listening votes as early as they possibly can. The early vote matters, and here's why. Let's say you have enough money to turn out 100 people on election day, and that's it. Your resources, the capacity, and 50 people vote before election day. Mm-hmm. That means those 100 people you're turning out on election day is 150 votes, not 100 votes, right? So the way to think about this is by voting early, you're allowing Democratic campaigns to take you off the GOTV list, move to people who are less frequent voters, which is really important in a midterm election because there's much more, and get them to turn out to vote. So by you voting early, you're creating higher Democratic turnout.
Yeah.
And so that's part of what I think is beginning to kick in now. And the DNC this year, I just talked to the guy running all the grassroots stuff at the DNC, Roger Lau, a few minutes ago. And the DNC has spent close to $100 million this cycle growing the capacity on the grassroots level with state parties and with the campaigns to take advantage of exactly what we're talking about here, which is that in this end, we're now doing GOTV, not for 24 hours, but for 2 weeks. Donald Trump's party has decided to do GOTV for 24 hours. Well, that was stupid, right? And so we have a huge advantage now by seeing this early vote coming in so strong. It creates a virtuous cycle, which I think is going to mean that our vote is going to be higher than many of the polls had anticipated. So that's the summary of my optimistic view on the election right now.
It's so valuable because I think for those of us who follow politics through Twitter and other social media, sometimes that bit of information doesn't make it through because it's not sexy enough or whatever, what the DNC is doing on the ground, the GoTV effort. Yeah. Plus, these target early numbers are just astonishing to me. I'm looking at this tweet that you posted, was it 2 days ago? And not only are Democrats overperforming across the board, across the United States, but also in Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Virginia, Wisconsin. But astonishingly, given the fact that the Republicans are the underdogs coming in during a year in which they typically will gain seats in Congress, they're actually underperforming across the board between 2020 and right now. What do you attribute that underperformance to, where the Republicans just seem to be lagging, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 points behind 2020?
Right. So listen, the real question in this election, so in 2020, a lot of political commentators and pollsters got burned because the electorate was more Republican than polling was suggesting. And so the sort of the bias coming into this election was to sort of think, well, you know, last time the electorate was 2 to 3 points more Republican than we thought. So, you know, if I see it even, that means, you know, it's probably 2 to 3% more Republican. There was sort of a bias that there was this hidden Republican vote, right? Yeah, okay. That the polling wasn't picking up for whatever reason, whether it was shy Trump voters. I mean, there's a lot of different theories about what happened, but there was sort of this bias that, you know, this was going to be a red wave year. The inflation was too high. Biden's approval was terrible. And then we learned it really wasn't a red wave year. And then Roe happened. And then what, and this is really important for your listeners, probably the most exciting thing that's happened and the thing that keeps me most optimistic is that there were 5 House special elections in the months after Roe ended. And in those 5 elections, we outperformed our 2020 number in those elections by 7 points on average. In the New York 19 race, which we won, which nobody thought we were going to win, we were losing that race in our own polling by 3 to 4 points on election day, and we won by 2.5 points. In Kansas, the margin was even bigger. So in actual elections, not polling, and actual elections matter more than polling, right? It's how people vote. There's been a hidden Democratic vote. We've been overperforming polling. We've been overperforming expectations. And the question really was, in this election, was would that dynamic that we saw happen in Alaska and in New York and in Kansas, right, would it continue through the general election? And so far, the early vote data suggests that it is, and that, you know, we're seeing Democrats overperforming polling and expectation because Democrats are fired up and ready to go, because the combination of the January 6th committee hearings, the ending of Roe, the extremist abortion restrictions, Trump's just general venality and malevolence that is thrown in our face every day, the extremism of the Republican Party and MAGA, it reminded the anti-MAGA majority that voted in such overwhelming numbers in these last 2 elections about why they had voted against MAGA. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the key now for us is to continue to work as hard as we can, to continue to spread positive sentiment and good news. And because I think in a time when people are scared about the future of their country, there's a limit to how much fear is a motivator here. I think we have to balance the fear that we all feel with a sense that there really is, that we can do something positive and constructive about it, not just wallow in the darkness and the worry and the concern. And of course we can. And we just saw it. We picked up 2 House seats that nobody thought we would pick up, right? Mm-hmm. We're leading in states that nobody thought we would lead in. We're competitive in states that nobody thought we'd be competitive in. Let's be very clear. 6 months ago, no one thought we had a shot, and we got a shot here. The glass is half full. It's incredible where we are. It's a testament, frankly, to the grassroots of the Democratic Party, who've given us our candidates the money that they've needed to compete in a very tough environment. And it's a testament to the hard work of Democrats all across the country that are doing the work, right? They're early voting, they're making their calls, they're doing their texting, and they're you know, creating energy that we need to be able to win, close strong and win this thing.
Okay, for just a second, let's talk After Party. Every Friday, Kimberly Johnson and I record a fourth Bob Seska Show podcast for the week. But this one's totally different from the usual Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday shows. The Friday After Party podcast is loaded with all the politics you want, while also including uncensored, completely obscene conversations about sex, drugs, movies, television, our personal lives, all the crap we can't get away with on the free shows. So please help support this podcast by subscribing to our Friday After Party for just $10 per month. And bonus, you're also going to get two Shadow Docket shows every damn week included in that level of support. That's BobSeskaShow.com or just click the all caps Patreon link beneath the logo at BobSeska.com. Thank you.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Bob Seska!
Let's say you're a pollster and you're looking at the current numbers right now, certainly some of the aggregators, Nate Silver and so on, and you're seeing, a certain set of results being forecasted. But at the same time, you also see, as you were saying, the results of all these special elections where Democrats have overperformed significantly. How do you square that? If you're a pollster, how do you square the reality of the special elections, the reality of these early vote numbers, which are astonishing? I mean, Wisconsin with Republicans underperforming by 11 points. My God, how do you square that with the poll numbers that you're seeing at the same time? I know a lot of my audience is constantly questioning the validity of polls, and I think for good reason.
Let me talk about that because I address this a lot when I speak. Is that so? First of all, the states that we're doing really well in right now are Georgia, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, really encouraging data in those states. Three states where we're not doing as well as we need to be, but not by a lot, but just not as well as other states are Arizona, Nevada, and North Carolina, right? Mm-hmm. We got to keep an eye on those states. But it isn't like we're doing badly. We just need to be doing better, right? I mean, the way to think about it. And there's time. And Nevada had a crazy windstorm on the first 2 days of early voting, and basically nobody voted. I mean, that's part of the reason why this early voting and vote by mail thing happens, is you can have bad weather events, you can have the electricity grid can go down on election day, right? And you want to give people the option of voting early. So I do think that we're seeing, really some very positive signs. For me, in some ways, the most positive of all the things I'm seeing is Wisconsin, because we're trailing in the polls there, and recently Barnes has been struggling a little bit. And, we have a phenomenal party chairman in Wisconsin who's now been there for several cycles and knows the state. And, just the data coming out of there early is very encouraging. And let's see. I mean, we need to win, some combination of, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, and Wisconsin. We need to try to win all four. And, we're doing, the Georgia numbers are also very strong. I mean, really, really impressive early vote numbers for the Democrats in Georgia, encouraging numbers. On the issue of polling, let me say this. Mm-hmm. Polling is it's a suggestion. It's a moment. It's a snapshot in time. It's not a predictor of anything. It can change, an election can change on a dime. And the polls weren't wrong in 2016 because what happened was the election changed at the end. And the actual national polls at the end were only off by a single point. So we didn't have bad polling in 2016. We didn't have bad polling in 2018. But in 2020, there was definitely you know, we thought the election was going to be better than it was, even though we won and we flipped the Senate. We thought it was going to be even better. And there are questions now that part of what's happening, if I can just do this very simply for your, you know, for your listeners without going into the 10-minute discussion of this, which would bore everybody, is that we have a lot of new voters in our, we've seen an enormous expansion of the electorate in the last two elections. We had historic turnout in 2018, historic turnout in 2020. And what that means is that the art of predicting who's going to vote is now harder than it was. Yeah. It's there's more complexity because we have so many new and irregular voters in the system now, more than anybody. I mean, here's an amazing statistic that I just saw from a group called Catalyst. They, in 2020, 40% of the people who voted in Nevada had not voted in Nevada in the presidential election in 2016.
Wow.
Yeah, no, that's a crazy number, yeah. Right? Like, so it means that you're dealing with an entirely new electorate, new people. How do you know who's going to vote? How do you know that they're there? And so I think that that's one piece of it, is that we're in a period where polling is going to be more bouncy and more less accurate, perhaps, mm-hmm. than it's been in the past because of this enormous influx of new and irregular voters, which makes, you know, understanding who's really going to vote much harder than it used to be when there was a more static electorate. The second thing that is also we're seeing play out in this election is that mm-hmm. polling of Hispanics is very hard. Polling of young people and Hispanics is hard because just finding them, reaching them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the percentage of Hispanics and young people in the electorate is growing. And Hispanics have there's a particular problem with polling Hispanics, which is if you're a Spanish speaker, primarily a Spanish speaker, you don't respond to English polling, and Spanish speakers are more Democratic than English speakers. And so if you poll Hispanics only in English, you're going to get a sample that's much too Republican, which is part of the reason why you've seen this cycle. The polling with Hispanics has been really all over the place. Like, I mean, crazy variances in the polling. Just in Texas, there have been polls in the last month with Abbott up 4 with Hispanics, and then yesterday, Univision dropped a poll showing Beto up 30, right? Yeah. So how do you get that kind of difference? And it's part of what I was just describing. So, yes, you have to take all polls with a grain of salt, which is why what I do with polling is I look at the polling averages on 538. I think, to me, it's the best place to go looking at averages. And you have to look at trends. You know, if things are moving all in the same direction, that's meaningful. And so, for example, in my Twitter feed, I talked about how, you know, 3 of the national tracks that were just released all showed 3 to 4 point movement towards the Democrats. Well, one of those polls, we were up by 4, and another one, we were down by 8, but it showed us moving from 8 to 5, right? And that's a trend, and that's what you have to look at. So, you know, the key is not to get overly freaked out by polling. It's part of our life. It's an important piece of data, but it's not the only thing that matters. And I do think that what is happening in this election cycle is there's a lot now of junky, quick and dirty polls, which are mm-hmm. not terribly accurate,
yeah.
which are overwhelming some of the more high quality polls. And so it's becoming harder just for an average person, right, to mm-hmm. understand and wade their way through all this craziness.
You know, a perennial source of frustration for Democrats many, many years, as long as I've been following politics, certainly, has been young voters turning out. Where do you see that voting block ending up this year? Are they going to be helpful? Are they going to overperform? Or yeah. is it going to be pretty much status quo?
Well, I don't think we know yet. And yeah. I think what's really important for people to recognize is that this has been one of the biggest changes in American politics. 20 years ago, under 45-year-old voters were a jump ball. It was
oh, yeah.
Yeah, Democrats did not have an advantage of any kind. Now we have between a 15 and 25 point advantage among under 45-year-old voters. We lose voters over 45,
mm-hmm.
and we win voters under 45 by an enormous margin. That margin, if it's 10, you know, there's a big difference between that margin being 10 points and being, you know, 22 points or 23 points, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm a little worried about what's going to happen with young people in this election. Let me give you sort of the positive case and the negative case. And I'm a little worried because I think that Biden's age has become material to younger Americans, that he feels very distant and disconnected. And I think that And I worry that at the end of the day, we're not going to have both the turnout and the performance that we really need. And I'm worried about it. I'm not telling you that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But here's the positive case, right? The thing that's unknown is that there's been a series of things that have happened that have, I think, shaken and woken up young people for them, given them a reason to get into the game.
Yeah.
And that's the gun violence that we've seen, which is a major voting issue for young people. It's the abortion restrictions, which, you know, affect young people, you know, almost exclusively, mm-hmm. right? People of childbearing age. It's the climate bill that passed, which was the biggest and most important climate bill, you know, in American history, which was something that's a voting issue for young people. Biden also did the student loan forgiveness, which is a huge issue for young people, and also the cannabis reform, the marijuana reform. And all those things together, I think, you know, could be enough for a marginal young person who's like, you know, I don't really like either party, and Biden's old, and I don't really feel connected to the Democrats, and my candidate in my district, I don't, you know, I'm new to living here. I've moved here to get a job. I don't really know them, you know, but I'm going to vote anyway, right? And I think that one of the other things that makes me optimistic is the early vote stuff. I think that what's happening now, you know, is that for 2 to 3 weeks, people who are not sure they're going to vote are being, you know, the whole reason we go door knocking and we make phone calls and we text people is that it puts social pressure on people. It's called social pressure, right? It's other people in your community telling you, hey, I voted. I want, you know, you should vote too. Well, all these stories about the early vote and all these people voting is now 2 weeks of social pressure on everybody.
Yeah.
And where that may matter the most is with young people for Democrats in a midterm election, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the reasons why it's important for all your audience and your listeners to be talking and promoting the idea that, wow, it's really great for the United States in a time when our democracy is being challenged, that we're seeing such high turnout, you know, record turnout all across the country. It's an affirmation of the strength of our democracy, and hopefully it will encourage other people to vote. I think these are important sentiments that we need to be putting into the electorate, and they're true, right? It's mm-hmm. actually an incredible repudiation of all the Republican BS around the elections and the cheating and everything else, that all these people are voting early. And what's amazing to me, I was talking to somebody about this today. If the Republicans really believed this election cheating thing, right? If they really believed it, mm-hmm. right? What would you have done? Then you would have encouraged all of your voters to vote early.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Because then you're like, well, then they can't cheat. Your vote came in 2 weeks before. They can't knock it out on election day or discount it or do whatever these dirty Democrats do, right? And instead, what they did is they made it more likely their voters weren't going to vote at all.
Yeah.
By trying to push people to election day. Which is just, it's a sign of just how bonkers MAGA has gotten on, mm-hmm. on basic fundamental things. I mean, their obvious response to their concerns about our democracy would have been to have encouraged all their voters to vote early, and they didn't do that.
In fact, what they're doing is they're depressing their own turnout by, first of all, measuring the drapes way too early. I mean, I think there's a lot of attitude on the Republican side that, oh, we've got this. We at least have the House. That's a given. And they're behaving that way, and I think that might depress their turnout, on top of what you're saying with the obvious sort of demonization of the early voting process, of the mail-in voting process, which would only otherwise help them, but they've decided because of Trump, whatever delusions he had about all of that, based on his insecurities, we should not do that. We should make sure that we avoid voting by mail and doing all the things that could help our side actually win elections. I'm okay with that if that's what they want to do, if that's the approach they want to take. I'm just saying it's probably undermining their own efforts.
Yeah, look, they made... As somebody who has been in the expectations game in the last few months and, mm-hmm. you know, on the media, you know, and on TV and stuff, they made an enormous mistake. And they've made a lot of really big errors this cycle. I mean, first, you know, they ran towards MAGA, a politics that had just been rejected twice by the American people. That was a political mistake. The second thing is that, you know, these radical Supreme Court decisions, you know, were a mistake for the Republican Party.
Yeah.
You know, next, their candidates haven't raised a lot of money. That was a mistake. They didn't do a good job in redistricting, and redistricting came out better for us than we had expected. That was a mistake. Them, you know, declaring it a red wave and telling everybody the election was over before it had happened was a mistake, right? And I think that what everyone has to realize on at this moment of like, are we going to win? How much time is I going to spend? Am I going to get disappointed? Keep one thing in mind, right? They're an unbelievable mess. That this party, given all the things I just discussed and all of their craziness and lunacy and delusional thinking and, you know, all this stuff, is going to somehow amount an effective election day operation, right, across the country, it's just not likely, right? It's just not, I mean, their candidates have very little money. And so the idea that somehow after all these mistakes and their lunacy and their craziness and their delusions, they're going to somehow become this formidable force in the last 2 weeks and take the election away from us, I don't think that's going to happen. And so it's just why we have to be relentlessly optimistic, because they're crazy. They don't deserve to be in power. They are. They will be dangerous if they are. And we have to leave it all on the playing field. We really only have one choice, right, in terms of how we respond to all of this. It's just we have to work as hard as we possibly can. That's all we can do.
Okay, one last break. Back with more Simon Rosenberg after this.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Bob Seska plays more music. And there's a conventional wisdom out there, in spite of everything you just said, which I absolutely agree with, that, oh, well, gas prices and inflation are going to supersede all of the ridiculousness on the Republican side, and people go out and vote for them anyway because they're pissed off about gas prices. Is this overshadowing of other positive economic indicators a press creation? Is this effective Republican messaging? What has caused this kind of eclipsing of things like unemployment being super low? I mean, we're probably going to see positive GDP growth tomorrow, right?
Yeah. No, the GDP numbers tomorrow is going to be an opportunity to reintroduce some of the positive accomplishments of Joe Biden and the Democrats. And just for your listeners, I mean, I write about this a lot on my Twitter feed and on my website at ndn.org. Let me just give you a few statistics, right? I mean, just to bulk, you know, get people fired up and ready to go, right?
Yeah.
So, since 1989, when the Cold War ended and we moved to a single global economy, which we had not been until communism fell, there have been 44 million jobs created in America. There's 42 million of those have been created under Democratic presidents, 96%.
Wow.
42 million Democratic jobs, 2 million Republican jobs. And that's over 18 years of Democratic presidents and 16 years of Republican presidents. So it's about the same amount of time. We've created a lot of jobs. They've done basically nothing, right? Mm-hmm. We've had three consecutive Democratic presidents preside over a growing economy and vastly lower budget deficits. Three consecutive Republican presidents have led the country to recession and spiraling increasing budget deficits. So the exact opposite of the understanding of the Republican Party being the party of fiscal responsibility. Mm-hmm. Third, Joe Biden's created, there's been 10 million jobs created under Joe Biden so far. That's five times as many as were created in the 16 years of the last three Republicans combined. And 500,000 jobs a month are being created under Joe Biden. Under the last three Republican presidents, that was 10,000 jobs a month. Mm-hmm. So he's creating jobs at 50 times the rate of the last three Republican presidents.
Just incredible.
And then finally, a couple more stats. During Biden's presidency, we've seen the lowest uninsured rate in American history, mm-hmm. the lowest poverty rate in American history, the lowest unemployment rate in a peacetime economy since World War II. We're seeing elevated new business formation. We're having, you know, in a typical month, there'd be about 200,000 small businesses created in America. Under Biden, it's been up at 400,000 consistently now throughout almost his entire presidency. And we also are seeing wages are up now at a higher rate, going up at a higher rate than they've been in decades. And so, yes, in the way I talk about the economy is we've gone through an incredible economic boom. You know, we have all these, you know, millions of jobs being created. Incomes are way up for people. The, you know, we have a worker shortage throughout the United States. Mm-hmm. Poverty, uninsured, all, the, you know, we've also made historic investments that are going to create long-term growth for 25 years and help us win the industries of the future. Historic investments we've made in the future. And yes, inflation's too high. And but it's not that inflation's too high and all these other things have happened. These things have happened and inflation's too high. We have a plan for that. And by the way, if you're angry about inflation, high gas prices, you should be angry at Vladimir Putin and MBS of Saudi Arabia, not at Joe Biden.
Bingo.
Because they raise gas prices in order to try to push the Democrats from being able to win the election because they don't like what we're doing on clean energy. They don't like what we're doing to preserve democracy in abroad. They don't like Joe Biden's strong leadership. So they use the tools that they had, which is to increase gas prices to try to cause us to lose the election. If Republicans were so angry about rising gas prices, they should be angry at Vladimir Putin and MBS. Mm-hmm. But instead, they're angry at us. So they're now in essence, a partnership with mass murderers and autocrats in a political partnership to weaken the Democratic Party and, frankly, weaken the United States. And so it's a tragedy, and I wish we had done a better job, to your point. Mm-hmm. I think we have work to do. If I could just give my counsel to the family, the single most important thing we have to do and solve is we should not be losing the economic argument to the Republican Party, given all the data that I just went through. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they have a 10 to 15 point advantage on us on the economic issues, we just are not going to be able to get to that point we discussed earlier of getting up to 54 or 55% of the vote if we don't improve the public's understanding of what happens to the economy when we're in power, what happens to the economy when they're in power. So this is a big party-wide project that we have to take on over the next few years. There's an urgency about this. And certainly I think on Thursday when the GDP numbers come out, I have a feeling you're going to be hearing Joe Biden talk incessantly for the next few days about the progress the country's made under his watch.
Absolutely. And before I let you go, Simon, in advance of election night, how should we prepare ourselves emotionally? I get the sense from the past couple of national elections that things will initially look bleak, and then the early and absentee ballots will start rolling in and we'll start to feel better. How do we set ourselves up for a sort of roller coaster ride 2 weeks from yesterday?
We don't know what's going to happen. And I think there are going to be surprises. I think, you know, drinking a lot is probably a good idea on election
good
night.
Advice, yeah.
I think that's probably my, you know, and I think we probably, you know, be prepared if you really, you know, to stay up very late because there's going to be very consequential elections on the West mm-hmm. Coast and in the Western part of the United States. And so, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's some elections that I've nailed and other elections I've misread and gotten wrong. My instinct on this is that this is going to be very, very close and that neither side is going to put this election away and that it will, and therefore we just won't know until election night, the day after. And I know that part of the reason the Republicans are trying to push everyone to Election Day is to sort of get that immediate thing, so it looks like the Democrats are manipulating. But I think the media is too smart for that now, and I don't think they're going to let them get away with that. And, you know, they're going to try to declare the election over at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. I just think it's going to be perceived by the national media and the TV folks as being ridiculous. And I think there's an understanding about this now. I think last time they got kind of caught, right? Because the Republicans had never tried that before. So I just think that let me close with this advice.
Okay.
And is that you don't want to be sitting there on Tuesday night at 8 o'clock and think, you know, I should have done another shift of calls into Pennsylvania on Sunday, and I should have given 50 more bucks. You can't have any regrets, folks.
Yep.
Right. You got to do everything you can, and everything you do matters. You know, whether it's texting, phone calling, canvassing, giving money, you know, tweeting, bothering all your friends to go vote early, however you bother them, every single step you take, it matters. It all matters.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine millions and millions of people taking those steps together. The chorus gets very loud when that happens. And so, you know, just do what you can. And there is no right or wrong about what that is. There's just what you can do, and just go do as much of it as you can before now on Election Day. And fingers crossed, everybody. And Bob, thanks for your great work. Seriously, thank you for what you do.
Thank you, Simon. Yeah, we got to leave it all on the field, as they say. Yep. So you have to follow Simon Rosenberg on Twitter at SimonWDC, link in the description. The same with the website, ndn.org. Thank you again, my friend. This has been invaluable. I can't tell you. So really, really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks so much, Bob. Good luck with everything.
Talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Well, I've been twisting this plane, pissed and dismayed. Ain't got no idea, but bound by fate. Is it slipping away? At the crux of my will it leave a mark? Or will it cut? It cut, cut me right here. Ain't got a job. The job ain't got me. Got no measured response. I guess I must be free. But calling everyone. Calling everyone. Turn everyone. Calling everyone.
can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.